Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And a little later in the show, we are going to be talking about the reality of refugees coming into this country with the mayor of Clarkston, Georgia. And outside of that, we're talking about exactly what I bet you think we are, the WikiLeaks data dump and the Republican health care bills. So to get right into it here, in a bombshell release this morning, WikiLeaks has struck again. This time releasing thousands of pages of CIA documents outlining their entire arsenal, or what appears to be their entire arsenal, of cyber weapons. Most notably, the report is a sign that already the CIA has lost control of this very extensive arsenal of attacks. The information came to WikiLeaks after having been circulated amongst various intelligence contractors and former agents. So ultimately, all of these capabilities that have been revealed could be in the hands of any range of people and are, of course, in the digital arsenal of the U.S. government already. The banner headline is that the CIA has found ways to defeat encryption on almost all brands of smartphones and in popular messaging apps like Signal, WhatsApp, and Telegram, which are known for their encryption. Also notable was the confirmation that Samsung smart TVs can be turned into both visual and audio recording devices. The documents also reveal that the CIA was attempting to figure out ways to be able to remotely control and exploit the varying computers inside of cars. In other words, the CIA has very effectively infiltrated the Internet of Things and has vast powers to take over phones and other appliances. In the case of both phones and TVs, they've created a fake off function that makes your device appear to be off while still allowing audio recording. The release also details some CIA spycraft in terms of how their tech experts enter and exit countries on diplomatic passports and hide in plain sight as technical consultants. It also revealed that the U.S. consulate in Frankfurt, Germany is a major center of espionage activities. It also detailed, yes, there's a lot in here, quite notably, that the CIA maintains a vast trove of information about other hacks that allows them to cover their tracks and make it appear as if someone other than the CIA actually committed the hack in question. Maybe even Russians. The release also shows that the Obama administration promised that the Obama administration made to share the various vulnerabilities the government hackers were finding with the private businesses where the vulnerabilities were was a lie. Because the CIA has deliberately left certain software unsecure to protect their own backdoor access. And as Edward Snowden has commented already on Twitter, the documents also reveal that they paid for some of these tools, i.e. that the government is paying to keep some of your devices unsecure. Which speaks to the danger of the whole thing. The CIA has developed a number of highly sophisticated tools that allow them to monitor digital communications in ways far beyond what was publicly known and often only guessed at in the tech community itself. These things open up massive vulnerabilities to people's privacy, but also create significant opportunity to actually physically harm someone as well, at the very least with the information they use, but also beyond that, use your imagination. It has not informed any companies of these vulnerabilities, which also means any number of other actors could have found them and exploit them. And now, because of the ease with which digital files can be copied and produced, have allowed many of these things to escape CIA control and thus potentially have furthered the proliferation of some of the most dangerous digital weapons there are. The leaker, who WikiLeaks did not reveal their identity, that is, stated they wanted these documents out to start a conversation in public about the weapons, their uses, their governance, and limitations on them, just like with other powerful weapons like nuclear warheads or landmines. There's a huge trove of documents available at the WikiLeaks website, which will continue to create stories for weeks now. But at the very least, enough has been revealed that a serious public discussion on cyber weapons is entirely warranted. Republicans have finally released their bill to replace the Affordable Care Act. And while it makes a number of important changes, it's worth noting that the fact that it bears family resemblance to the Affordable Care Act is a good reminder that the principles that govern the ACA were developed by Republicans, not left-wing radicals, the way many Republican lawmakers make it sound. We do not know exactly what the bill will cost, or how many people exactly will be uninsured if it was to pass. But it is safe to say that many people will lose their health insurance or see the quality of their care dropped based on these changes. So let's run down a little bit of what we know. On the Medicaid expansion, it's clear ground was given to Republican states that expanded Medicaid. The expansion will continue to be paid for, in a way, up till 2020, so people can still enroll in up to then. After that, the program is frozen. No one else can join except the people under the old rules. The Republicans, though, plan to place a per capita cap on individuals. So it's unclear if the money provided will actually be enough to cover the health care costs of people on Medicaid, and that ultimately – the way this could work out is that this Republican plan that allegedly keeps the expansion will double as a massive cut to Medicaid, which, you know, ultimately means a reduction in the quality of health care a Medicaid enrollee can have. The tax penalty for people who don't buy insurance is gone, but it's replaced with a sort of similar concept, which is if you have a gap longer than 63 days between healthcare plans, you have to pay a premium, a 30% premium when you re-enroll. So if you leave a job with healthcare and can't afford a plan within 63 days, you have to pay a big penalty or just don't want to get one. Ultimately, it means that it encourages people who aren't that sick to not re-enroll until they are actually sick, which means that fewer people in the market who are healthy and paying lower premiums and people who are coming in who are sicker and paying higher premiums. It's just not a good look overall. Premiums for everyone will go up. So bad. The ACA puts caps on how much you can charge older people over younger people who enroll. The Republican plan eliminates that. So grandma and grandpa will get soaked by insurance companies when they try to sign up over the age of 50. The ACA provides tax credits to everyone up to 400% of the poverty line, roughly $50,000 for a family of four. The Republican plan gives tax credits to everyone to buy health insurance, however, somewhat differently. Anyone who makes under $75,000 will get a relatively large tax credit. It's the most generous one out of all of them. But that also means that people between $75,000 for an individual now. So a lot of people who could probably afford health insurance will now be getting a tax credit who couldn't before. It also means that the subsidies for the people making over $75,000, which are prorated based on age, and it looks like you get more when you're older. But since they can charge older people more, the value of the tax credit actually goes down the older you get, which makes it more and more difficult to maintain good quality of health care. So ultimately, what this all boils down to is America does its health care in the dumbest way possible. Clearly, a single-payer system based on a payroll tax is a much more logical option and is used by most other industrialized nations. The massive for-profit insurance industry has completely commodified our health insurance and made it impossible to actually provide quality health insurance to the whole population. Instead, it creates Frankenstein monster bills like, actually, quite frankly, the ACA, known as Obamacare, and now this Republican plan that are all designed in ways to keep insurance companies and big hospital companies raking in the cash as much as they are to help people actually get health insurance, which almost seems to be an afterthought in the way these plans are actually crafted. The Republican plan will absolutely grow the number of people without insurance, increase the cost of insurance, and decrease the ability of people to buy affordable insurance that is also quality. And further, it does so in a way that appears to pit younger people against older people to sell the popularity of the bill. Like if you're young and healthy, oh, hey, that sounds great. However, that's a Trojan horse because if you are young, newsflash, you will be old. And thus the benefits of this change will be less and less as time goes on. This has nothing to do with the free market as Republicans are selling it since, in fact, this is still a highly regulated healthcare system. And it really is just about insurance company profits. And that's the bottom line. Those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are joined in studio to continue our conversation with Grant Berowich, news analyst here at Radio Sputnik, graduate of Wake Forest University, so he must be intelligent. Grant, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Eugene. Happy to be on, and go Deeks. Hoping to get a NCAA tourney bid here.
It could happen. It could happen. My Virginia Cavaliers, though, looking good in the ACC. But we'll bring you on for another show when we get to the NCAA tournament. We're going to do a show on that. We hadn't planned it, but I've just decided. Anyway, so the Republican health care plan, it's now out. I don't know. To me, the most interesting thing is that it started out with, like, we're going to completely scrap Obamacare, and now it sort of seems like, I hate to say this because Rand Paul put it, but I think he's right to some degree, it's kind of quote-unquote Obamacare lite.
Obamacare lite, Obamacare 2.0. There's a couple different ways we can repackage this. And frankly, it makes a whole lot of sense, right? Because this is something that came out of the Heritage Foundation in 1993, had a broad bipartisan – or had Republican support, notably Chuck Grassley, Orrin Hatch, some of your longtime GOP Senate vets. One of the things that I find very interesting in the new scheme is, you know, we have Sean Spencer getting up there today talking about, and this is something the Obama administration talked about as well, is the young people not signing up. And what's really sort of distorted about this is that the insurance companies profit off of community engagement. So like by the community, like by the group, you know, kind of being unified is something that's really good for insurer profits. This is something that seems strange to me that, you know, the insurance companies need these risk pools and balance risk pools in order to make money. So insurance companies know that it's not smart for young people to buy health insurance. That's why there's so much of, that's why you have to have Sean Spicer get up there and run an ad for you. And so, I mean, there's a bunch of things that one, it's definitively not a repeal and replace plan. We have a whole slew of aspects of the massive Obamacare law, which again, like intertwined with so many different agencies, Medicare, quality of care, program integrity, biosimilars, workforce reform, and the Indian Health Service are all completely unaffected by the new legislation. So they're trying to say that, oh, this is the repeal of the replacement. But in fact, there's a whole lot of things that this does not address, which is somewhat good, right? I mean, in the sense of there are certain things about the old law that we'd like to keep, I think. But I think this government, you know, this, oh, we're getting rid of the government mandate. This is a really interesting point because of, like you said, like this continuous coverage. Oh yeah, like there,
it's just a mandate under another name. The whole and it's again, it's designed at the younger people. Like, hey, if you don't want to enroll because you feel healthy for like 3 years or whatever, and you're going to urgent care, just know that 3 years from now you're going to have to pay a 30% premium. But and this is what I mentioned. So then it's like, well, why would I stay up for 3 years? I'll just wait until I actually need health insurance.
Yeah.
It's interesting. What do you think about this Medicaid expansion? I mean, it seems like it's interesting because it's like a quote unquote maintaining the expansion, but while actually redefining how much money they're going to spend. So they'll spend way less money than what would have been spent
yeah,
before.
I mean,
so Medicaid,
I think there's
not
like
as good of a benefit.
Exactly. There's some sort of smoke and mirrors, I think, going on with the Medicaid expansion. Like, because now they're saying like, oh, like after 2020, there's not going to be a Medicaid expansion. And the per capita limit is something that is probably going to get a lot of pushback in the Senate. I mean, even among Senate Republicans. I think another kind of, and this kind of segues into something that I did a little bit of the math, and with the House's 241 seats, the Freedom Caucus is not, this is going to be a really interesting group to watch in the House, because there's about 32 votes in this caucus. If they unanimously as a caucus oppose it, And you add that to the Dems' 194 seats, that's 226 votes for against this sort of, you know, this new Ways and Means Committee bill and the Energy and Commerce Committee bill. This might not even get through the House, let alone the Senate, let alone to President Trump's desk. And they're saying this is going to get done in 3 weeks. So with the Affordable Care Act, we had over 79 hearings over a year. We heard from 181 witnesses. There were 121 amendments accepted from the public in order to make this a law that incorporates what the public thinks.
Mm.
And the Republicans are trying to slam it through. They want to get it through Congress in 3 weeks. Is this Democratic? We already know that Trump met with a bunch of health insurance executives. He met with a bunch of he's met with a bunch of pharmaceutical executives. The new bill says nothing about drug costs.
Right.
There's been no CBO, Congressional Budget Office estimate.
And they're trying to avoid one, too. I saw some Republicans say that they think they can do it without one, which just is ironic because they're the one who always wanted the CBO scoring. It's like the Paul Ryan's little mantra there.
I believe the Congressional Budget Office is a service that the legislature pays for.
Yes, it does. In fact, they set it up because their staff was actually inadequate to evaluate what was going on. So they had to set up a separate office to like actually figure out what's going on.
So they're trying to circumvent the very institution that they set up to create a check on themselves, which is awfully ironic, but maybe not unsurprising.
I mean, and it's probably because they know that this is going to get a lot of people kicked out of healthcare, and it's probably the cost benefit is not going to be that great.
No.
And so the more examined it is, the more the thing is going to start to fall apart.
It's going to fall apart, Eugene. It's like, you know, Heritage Foundation care turned Romney care turned Obamacare light.
Mm.
It's just watered down, and Trump has said, you know, let's get insurance for everybody. There's nothing in this bill that suggests that there's going to be more people insured. It's a question of how many people are going to lose insurance. That's a serious problem.
And, you know, the top line from the White House is, you know, and I saw Tom Price a little bit speak. He said, we want to just make sure people can pick their doctor. But what's, I mean, people have never been able to pick their doctor. I mean, in the private health insurance market, like, you are restricted to the network, and it's pretty much always been that way.
Yeah. I mean, and this is something that insurance companies have a lot of leverage over. So I don't know. I mean, if you have the insurance companies in bed with the government and the insurance companies, I mean, like this HMO stuff, like, you can't get a whoever doctor you want. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very confined to certain areas and certain doctors that agreed to work with the insurance companies. At usually prices that are bad for patients. Another thing that we saw in this new bill that I think, which is partially why they want to avoid the CBO estimates, is that this gets rid of the medical device tax. This gets rid of the tanning tax. This gets rid of
the snooky tax.
The snooky tax, the infamous snooky tax. The high earners tax goes away, as does tax on high-end investments. And we also see that the controversial within elite think tank circles, the Cadillac tax.
Mm.
This is again going to be postponed, I think, 2025. Hmm. I mean, at this point, it's like you can't make some of this stuff up.
No, it's crazy. I mean, that basically means that they actually don't have the money to pay for the tax credits that they're going to give people unless they're going to make some sort of deep cut somewhere.
And this is what's crazy is that you know, they're touting it as tax credits. In fact, the Affordable Care Act did have tax credits. It had two forms. It had what were they called, like the CSR subsidies, cost sharing reduction subsidies, and then also the advanced premium tax credit, APTC. And so, you know, they're trying to say that this is, you know, part of the Republican tax reform. And but it's hocus pocus. It really is. Total hocus pocus.
I mean, really, the overall goal seems to just be to reduce the number of people who have health insurance based. But, well, let me put you like this. The people who the government helps to buy health insurance in some way because the market refuses to meet the need of all people to have health insurance.
It's totally targeted at low income and middle low income people. And these are the people that are going to be hurt by it the most.
So what's the most likely outcome? Do you think that the ACA just sort of stays where it is with maybe a couple tweaks? Or could this be a glimmer of hope for single payer healthcare as sort of the building collapses down on us?
This has been Republican, their, you know, tried and true talking point for 8 years. 8 years and zero consensus replacement plan.
I mean,
years.
I mean, crazy.
What's to think that we're going to get a legit replacement plan in 1 year? I mean,
no, it doesn't really make any sense. If they've all been sitting there for 8 years and they couldn't come up with something that they all could agree on in that amount of time, that just seems highly, highly unlikely. And the Senate is such a wild card now because you've got the people who are several of whom are up for re-election in 2018 from states that expanded Medicaid who don't want any part of this.
This can only go down.
Right.
The ship is crashing.
Yeah, I mean, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, that group of people. It just doesn't seem like it's at all possible that this thing's going to get through. And, you know, Trump is also a wild card because he seems to be basing what he's going to do based on how many people are going to get kicked off of insurance. And if the number looks too big, he's not touching it.
I mean, that's a huge thing. And hopefully that with health reform, the idea would be to expand coverage. There's nothing, again, Eugene, nothing in this bill that suggests more people will get covered. And so, like, is there like any shame? I mean, you just want to reduce the number of people. It's like, this is just okay. Like, yeah, you know, whatever.
We're just going to get rid of people with health insurance.
How is that replacement?
It is not. And I think that is a great way to underline it. We are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary. We're going to be back with much, much more. So I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the bombshell release by WikiLeaks of what appears to be documents detailing the entire cyber weapon arsenal of the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, a number of very advanced things. And we are very happy to be joined in this conversation by Chris Garofa, who's a web developer, a technologist out of New Haven, Connecticut, also a political activist and organizer. So really perfect person to cover a lot of the angles of this story. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Eugene, thanks so much for having me on.
No, of course, of course. So this is a pretty big release here by WikiLeaks. Many people are saying largest ever publication of confidential documents by the CIA, year zero, the first part of the series that I think is coming out tonight. I mean, as someone who works on this, I mean, I want to put this in some context for people. I've had some different things coming around. There are some people who have said to me, well, this is the end of all encryption, since it appears they've hacked into so many things successfully and, you know, none of this kind of stuff matters. I've seen other people say, well, you know, yes, the CIA has opened things up. So for people who are out there who I think have been trying to get more secure using things like Signal and other things like that, were those efforts all for naught now, or is it maybe perhaps not that devastating?
No, I don't think it's that devastating. This is certainly huge, and I think it's going to take actually some time to fully understand what exactly was released today. There's over 8,000 documents in just the first part of this series, and we really, you know, need to go through them. Certainly, there have been some news stories already, very high-profile stories, like from the New York Times, talking about an application called Signal, which, you know, has been promoted as a very secure, encrypted communications method for text messages and phone calls. You know, the New York Times this morning had this story saying essentially that Signal has been hacked by the CIA, which isn't actually true. What the CIA is doing in that case is they're targeting your phone, either an iPhone or an Android device, and they can get into any program, including Signal. So there certainly are things to be concerned about. There are things that activists and organizers and security-minded folks need to be concerned about here. But I think it's going to actually take a little bit of time to fully comprehend what this release documents means for us.
Well, and one thing I think that's interesting about this is, I mean, does this sort of reflect that, I mean, I hate to say it like this, but I don't know how else to say it, that we just can't really trust what the government is saying in terms of what their capabilities are? Because obviously, after the Snowden documents, one of the main things they said they would do was share all vulnerabilities they were finding with the companies so that people wouldn't be left open. And now clearly they refuse to do that. So it just seems like if the president says you're going to do it and you don't do it, I mean, should this undermine our confidence about all the assurances we're consistently given by NSA, CIA, FBI that they're not abusing our data?
It definitely undermines you know, my confidence in this, and I think people should, you know, be very critical and very concerned about, you know, what the government is doing with our data and anything we're putting out there online or anything we're even saying in our homes. You know, one of the important things to keep in mind here is that we all have a smartphone or maybe a smart TV or these things like the Amazon Alexa that are always on and always listening, even down to smart fridges, you know, some people have in their homes. And any of these devices can actually be hacked because they're always on, always connected to the internet. And we should be aware that the NSA, the CIA, and I'm sure other agencies we barely even know about are listening to them or have the capability of getting into them. Just today, actually, a court case, forget where it was, but there's a court case where the prosecution, the state, wanted to get recordings from an Amazon home device. And the defense actually has said that they're going to allow that. It's a murder case in the United States. I'm sure the NSA already has that recording, but I think this sets a precedent for the government in these types of cases.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. I think that that's very true. And it just reminds me maybe in terms of the framing here, and I think most people don't think about it like this, but the idea that these are cyber weapons. I mean, you know, especially with the proliferation of the Internet of Things, I mean, and one of the things that was released in this document, they were looking for how to take control of cars and things like that. I mean, that really many of these things that we've at least gotten a glimpse to, if someone who wanted to do many people harm got a hold of them, it could be quite dangerous, it seems.
Sure, and I think it's safe to say that people that are not the CIA already have access to a lot of these tools. WikiLeaks in their press release says the CIA has lost control of the majority of its arsenal. And that includes malware, viruses, Trojans, and other exploits for many types of devices. Now, we don't know where these are, but it could be that other states have them. It could be malicious independent actors. Things like hacking groups have them, and they're out there. But you know, I do have to say that that doesn't make me feel any more uncomfortable than the CIA or NSA having these tools themselves.
No, I think that's a good point. And for our listeners here, too, just to piggyback on that, to talk about how easy it is for these things to proliferate. Like, this isn't just like a missile, you know, where I'd have to have like a giant truck in some way to go like steal a missile from a high tech facility. These are types of weapons that can be sort of copied and spread around much more quickly and much more easily than sort of maybe the weapons of the past.
Absolutely. Once they're on the internet, once they're out there, they can be copied, they can be distributed, whether or not they're in public forums. Once it's, you know, I think we all know, once it's on the internet, it's out there. It's on, it's out there, and it's easier to distribute.
And, you know, one of those things that was mentioned in this that I think is extremely relevant for a lot of the conversations we've been having about hacking in America today is how they have this giant trove of the fingerprints of different things, of different actors, different people who have done different things to try to hide the things that they do. And, I mean, this was obviously a huge issue with the DNC leaks and all these other things is, you know, who actually did this and the government saying, well, we have unique identifiers that show that it was Russia. But, I mean, does this kind of prove that for the highest of high-level people, the state actors and the people with large access to lots of money and lots of computing power, that basically they can sort of go where they want and throw so many sort of clues out there that it would be difficult to ever figure out who did it?
Absolutely. And one of the documents that is in this is a list of do's and don'ts for their programmers, how to use encryption, what kind of encryption to use or not use, what kind of secure protocols to use, and basically says, don't draw attention to yourself, but if you have to, here's how to cover it up.
A get out of jail free card to some degree there as well.
Much.
Wow. Well, the other thing that sort of shocked me here is that some of this, a decent amount of this stuff, appears to be unclassified. And given that, like, what we found from the Snowden leaks, that they're just like classifying the most anodyne, random documents coming from different embassies that are just like telling things that you could learn, like news summaries are classified. How on earth did that? I think WikiLeaks called it the most astounding intelligence own goals in living memory. Why would they not, if you could even say, I mean, who knows? Why would they not classify this? Or at least some of it?
I mean, I don't know what's going on in the mind of the CIA or the Director of National Intelligence, but I think it actually makes sense to have this stuff not be classified and have it out there. And then the reasoning for that, I mean, if we go back, you know, 50 years with the buildup of nuclear arsenals of traditional and nuclear weapons, it was kind of put out there and sort of open if you were looking for it. And the U.S. wants to put other countries and other independent actors on notice that it has these tools, it has these methods, and that it can and will use them. And in fact, it has. You know, if we go back to 2010, there was a virus that infected computers in Iran, specifically computers controlling some of their nuclear program. And it was called Stuxnet, and it was very clear that it was the American and Israeli governments that did it, and neither of the governments really went out of their way to deny that. They kind of said, you know, didn't say much. They didn't really deny it. They want people to know that they have these capabilities. And if we go back to the election season, you know, cyber was the big word in many of the debates and in many of the conversations.
I'm glad you bring that up because it just makes me wonder. In the technology world itself, I mean, now that sort of now more of this is out amongst yourself and perhaps conversations you've had, I mean, how much of this is stuff that, like, people had thought, man, I bet they could probably do this based on this, that, and the third? Like, is this a confirmation of some of the things folks had thought they had been doing?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, you kind of stop yourself and think, is this conspiracy theory level stuff? But really, it's no surprise to me that they are doing this. I think the extent to which they have an entire organization with so many different levels and so much staff and all the tools they have is confirmation, actually, of what I believe many of us in the security field have already considered to be true. This is just a confirmation of that.
And I'm also curious, and this is just speculation, of course. We'll have to see how it plays out. But, I mean, obviously after the Snowden revelations, you know, security, privacy, all those things became certainly much more saleable. Businesses, technology companies trying to protect their own business model. It seemed like there was at least to some degree a little bit of a rift between the government and the technology world because it was undermining their business. I mean, could the release of this further maybe inflame some of that reality? Because now, obviously, I mean, not only are they, you know, breaking into people's stuff, but leaving potentially big back doors and other different possible exploits wide open for, I mean, since this goes back to 2013, who knows how many years, opening up quite a bit of problems for many of these companies, I think.
Yeah, especially now that a lot of these exploits have been kind of lost. The CIA has lost control of a lot of these exploits. Many of them are called zero day, which means that they're not even known to the manufacturer, that there is no patch or security fix for them in the software or the hardware. And I think it's going to cause a lot of issues. You know, we did see, I think it was it last year, you know, when the FBI went up against Apple in the San Bernardino case and, you know, tried to make Apple give them essentially a custom version of the iPhone software so they could, you know, unlock the phone. You know, Apple did stand up to them, but we know there are many other companies that are not doing that, that are saying, yeah, you know what, CIA, NSA, we'll work with you. We'll put a backdoor in our software. Give us a, you know, maybe a tax break or give us, you know, convince the government to do this or that for us.
No, I think that's very true. You know, it just was so, I think a lot of people when they're hearing this story are like probably thinking like, what's going to go on? What's happening? What's secure? What's not secure? And we can certainly get the things people can do to secure themselves. But, you know, for Apple and Google and others, I assume that now that they've heard this, they're going to start going back into everything. I mean, what's the next step for those companies? I mean, do they go back and look for these things now? Do they sue the government? I mean, is it possible for them to find some of these? Or is it like if they didn't find it already, you know, how would they find it now? I mean, is there any hope, I guess, what I'm trying to say, that now these companies will be able to sort of backstop this? Or is perhaps maybe the genie out of the bottle a little bit too much now?
No, I think there certainly is some hope. You know, I think that it's in the best interest of the corporations, you know, like Apple, Google, Samsung, to mitigate the damage that's been done to them already by these leaks. You know, I'm sure they all have internal teams who are looking, you know, security teams that are looking for these bugs, looking for others that get fixed. There's also an entire, you know, community of folks that are not in these companies, but that are white hat, that they are looking for security issues and reporting it to these companies in many, you know, many cases for payment as part of bug bounty programs, but that are doing it not to exploit them, but to secure the devices that we're all so reliant on today.
And for people who are thinking about this, I mean, what would be some of your, you know, just top line takeaways for people who are like, how do I make my data more secure?
You know, there's a lot of really simple things that people can do. First of all, if it doesn't need to be put out there, if it doesn't need to be on your phone or on Facebook, then don't put it there. You know, the other thing, you know, we all say, hey, don't open strange email attachments. You know, a very basic thing. Run an antivirus on your computer and keep it up to date. And if you need to, use an app like Signal to secure your communications. Use encrypted email, a program called PGP. And it's actually gotten much easier to set these things up. And keep your software up to date. So let's say you get that notification on your iPhone that says, you know, there's an iOS update available. Run that update because it likely contains a lot of security fixes.
And I think that's a good point, too, in terms of continuing to use a lot of these things and just making it more difficult for people to get into your data. Because, you know, from what I understand, even if, you know, all this is out there, it's not like every single person, right, could necessarily use those. I mean, some of these attacks and other things like that seem like they probably would take, you know, money, computing power, teams of people. So, I mean, obviously there are people out there can do this, including the government, of course, but it's not as just if like every person, like if I somehow was able to download this, I could just like sit on my Lenovo laptop and break into anyone's stuff.
You know, I think honestly, there's a mix in these tools, and we don't know exactly which ones have been lost by the CIA or really, we should say, put out there into the wild. So, you know, I would want to have a little more caution than that. Computers have gotten so powerful these days that it certainly is possible that many of these tools can be just run off your laptop.
Wow, you're scaring me here.
I was going to say, I don't want to paralyze anyone. I don't want to make anyone, you know, too nervous. I think we need to be, you know, certainly people need to be more aware of the information they're putting out there and the risks that they are taking by having these devices. You know, I certainly don't have a smart TV or an Amazon, you know, Alexa or Echo or anything like that in my home. But, you know, I'm talking to you on an iPhone right now, and there are certain trade-offs we have to make living in this world.
Yeah, no, for sure. And just, that speaks maybe to the underlying issue of why this document was given to WikiLeaks in the first place. Is that individual, whoever they may be, and thank you to that person, feels that there needs to be a broader discussion about these types of technologies, who's able to, you know, how they're developed, how they're governed, how they're used, what the oversight is. I mean, it seems like, not that this is always perfect, but, and I'm curious your thoughts about this, that in the same way that sort of we have conventions to govern, you know, ballistic missiles and conventions to govern landmines and things like that, that perhaps there needs to be not just like a U.S. conversation, but really a sort of a worldwide conversation about how these things are governed and dealt with.
Yeah, we absolutely need that. And we need to, these can be weapons. They certainly are weapons. And I think, like you said earlier, you know, a missile, you can't just copy a missile, but you can copy a virus. You can copy an exploit and get it out there very quickly and target tens of thousands of computers within minutes, really. Mm. We do need some sort of regulation for these things. But of course, then we have to look at the fact that it's, you know, the deep state that's running them. And they're not as traceable as, for example, you know, a missile.
Right.
This is just something that, you know, they can put out there. They can hide their tracks. And I think it's going to be up to individuals and organizations to keep themselves safe and secure.
No, I think that's a very good point. And certainly we've seen the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty has not, in fact, prevented the proliferation of nuclear weapons. So obviously these are imperfect devices. I mean, and also, too, I'm glad you raised this issue, because it seems like one big issue to me on all this kind of stuff, and the fact that this even took place in the first place, is that Congress and the oversight that they do on these intelligence agencies is not only basically zero, but it also seems like, you know, a lot of these people who are sitting up there making these decisions, they don't even know what's going on. And that, like, you know, whatever the CIA and the NSA tells them is happening is what they believe is happening. So beyond that, they don't have the base of knowledge, I think, like most people, unfortunately. But also, it just seems like there's a rubber stamp in Congress around sort of these different spying capabilities. And when it comes before them, they just say, oh, okay, is it against terrorism? Then fine. Like, let's not even think about it.
Yeah, I mean, they can trot out this whole idea of national security anytime they want to, and that basically gets them a rubber stamp and a blank check. But also, I think we have to realize that many people in high levels of government are not technical people. They're not technically minded. I mean, we have the vice president using an AOL account, you know. It's tough to explain that sort of thing. You know, we go back to the internet as a series of tubes comment from a few years ago. Mm. But, you know, I think, too, the other thing is that it's an issue with the dark state, too, or, you know, the deep state. You know, really, WikiLeaks kind of introduces these documents by talking about sort of a feud between the CIA and the NSA, which led to these technology divisions being created in the CIA itself pretty much after the 9/11 attacks. But I think we have to keep in mind that, you know, both agencies, they work for the same state and they work for the same system ultimately. And it's that, you know, that division might be between the agencies, but ultimately they report back to the same system and they have essentially the same goals in the end game.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It certainly reminds me of Lyndon Johnson when he was not 100% sure that the information he was getting from J. Edgar Hoover about activists and other people, he had the CIA then do Operation Chaos. And so they both had the same capabilities. They were kind of feuding with each other on so many different levels, but Johnson was able to sort of play them off against each other to drastically increase the amount of information he had and was bringing in regarding activists and others. So I think that's a great point. I mean, even if the CIA and the NSA are feuding, it doesn't mean that someone sitting over top of them can't actually perhaps use that feud, because if there's competition between the two to develop the best stuff, to some degree, that benefits the state overall and the things that they are able to do.
You're 100% right there. And the government at many layers, whether it's the parts of the government in the public eye or, you know, again, these parts of kind of the deep state, they know what their goal is. They're going to get there. They're going to do what they need to do to get there. You know, regardless of whether Congress approves it or not, you know, the NSA, the CIA, they have all these budgets that are just like black budgets, basically, where they just look at it and say, okay, here's billions and billions of dollars to do whatever that thing is you need to do. Don't bother telling us about it. We don't need to know about it. And that's where a lot of these programs are coming from.
Absolutely. Well, Chris, I appreciate that. I appreciate you coming on. This is a fast developing story, I know. So there's so many different elements of it that will continue to grow. So thank you for giving us some initial comments to help us guide and understand what is going on here with this case. That was Chris Garofa out of New Haven, Connecticut. He is a web developer technologist who works closely on all these security issues. We are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the ways that some of these big issues we talk about on a lot of different levels here are affecting some of the smaller cities and towns in America. And we are very happy to be joined again on this show by Mayor Ted Terry of Clarkston, Georgia. Mayor Terry, thank you so much for joining us here on the show.
Yes, happy to be here. Thank you.
No, of course, of course. And I want to just start by noting that Clarkston has been bringing in quite a few refugees into your city over the past 35 years, people from Bosnia, Syria, Iraq, I'm sure, other places. It's a one-square-mile city, but one of the safest cities in Georgia. So is it fair to say that a lot of maybe some of the myths out there about what refugees bring to America may be just that, myths?
Yeah, there's a discongruency between what is happening in Europe, where you literally have a million plus people walking across a continent and open borders that are mainly male refugees, compared to the refugee resettlement program that's run through the United Nations that has its own multi-layered vetting process along with the Homeland Security Department, as well as the Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan enhanced review. Threading that needle before you could potentially be qualified and vetted enough to be resettled to one of the 17 countries in the United Nations High Commission on Refugees Act. And so yeah, you're right. America finalized or formalized a resettlement process in the 1980s. 1980, Jimmy Carter signed the Refugee Act, and that's actually when a formal process of vetting of acknowledging that under the Geneva Convention, every industrialized nation has a responsibility to help and to provide some sort of refuge for people who are displaced. And so, you know, we're basically fulfilling our international treaty obligations as America, as part of the Geneva Convention. And I think that's why you saw where the President Trump did not completely ban all refugees. He just said that we're going to take half as many refugees. I think even he understands that the campaign rhetoric can only go so far and that we have international obligations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I'm originally from Charlottesville, Virginia. It's another small town. It's many refugees come there from all over the place, some of the similar areas. And, you know, a lot of the things that I hear, from my former friends and neighbors and witnessed with my own eyes was how it really actually had a big, well, one, economic benefit to the city, but two, also just sort of the range of diversity and sort of the tapestry of new people coming into the city is something that people really like. And over time has really added a very unique character. And I wonder in Clarkston if it's been a similar situation.
Yeah. And it's exactly right. And I didn't really answer your first part of your question. Just about safety and crime. Clarkston has continuously been one of the 50 safest cities in Georgia. I think that you could, just if you ever met a refugee, anyone meets a refugee, you understand that violence or committing crimes is literally the last thing they want to do. They're escaping violence. They're escaping crime. They have such reverence for America, the ones I talk to, because America has rescued them from purgatory. You know, refugee camps are basically purgatory. There's no long-term, medium-term future for the people who are sort of in this second country, forced to flee their homes in their first country. The average refugee is in a camp for almost 17 years. And so they understand how lucky they are to have made it through the gauntlet of vetting and to be, given this opportunity to resettle. And so as a result, we see, I actually see more crimes
perpetrated against refugees than, you know, than even, you know, any concern about refugees committing any sort of violent crimes. And then just about your question about this tapestry, I mean, you know, yes, some people, quite frankly, like gentrification. They like everything to be neatly manicured and everything needs to look exactly the same, cookie cutter this. And, you know, that's great. There's plenty of those options in metro Atlanta. We got lots of suburbs and exurbs. But, you know, I think the people who, at least for me, I mean, I chose to live in Clarkston because I feel it actually represents the best of what America has to offer. And, yeah, it's not going to be 100%, you know, this utopia world. I mean, we have our issues. We've got a little bit of a, you know, a litter bug issue. You know, we've got some slum lords that we're trying to deal with, people who are, you know, apartment complex landlords that are taking advantage of refugee tenants, and we're working through those issues. One of my neighbors the other day, I drove into my neighborhood, and there is a Burmese family, and they painted their house Pepto-Bismol pink. So, you know, but these are sort of the most of our concerns. Right. You know, it's maybe sort of more aesthetical issues, or, oh, these people talk funny, or they dress differently, or they have different rituals. But without a doubt, you know, it makes things so much more interesting. The food options are amazing. The cultural opportunities. I mean, we're talking about 1 square mile where you have a mosque right across the street from a Buddhist temple, right down the street from a Bhutanese Hindu temple, and every imaginable, every, you know, sort of major Christian denomination, Ethiopian Orthodox, Vietnamese Baptist, International Bible, AME churches, all within this 1 square mile. And these people are living in harmony. You know, there's no religious wars happening. There's no Muslims versus Christians versus Hindus versus Buddhists. People are focused on living the American dream, and they're highly, highly motivated to do right, follow the law, pay their taxes, learn English. I'm very impressed by the level at which refugees pick up English. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that the resettlement program is a very short leash, a short lifeline. I equate it to throwing someone in the deep end to learn how to swim, and you give them a floaty, but you say that floaty is going to deflate after 6 months. And then after 8 months, we're going to basically take away most of your lifelines. So you're going to have to learn how to swim. And the great news for at least Georgia anyways is, you know, we're anywhere between an 85 to 90% self-sufficiency rate within 180 days. And that means that there's a full-time, you know, worker paying the bills, paying their rent, paying their groceries in that household of refugees. And that's important because there is that myth out there that refugees are, you know, basically are a charity case.
Right.
That they're going to come here and we're going to be taking care of them for the rest of their lives. And it couldn't be further from the truth. We have people who are at least, you know, in parts of Clarkston and parts of North Georgia who are doing jobs that, quite frankly, no other American worker will do. And, you know, a great example of that is the poultry industry. Now, Georgia is the chicken capital of the world. More chickens are made here per capita than anywhere else in the world. And the majority of the workers there are refugees, and they're making $7.25 an hour. That's the minimum wage, and they're working, you know, 12, 14-hour shifts. You know, I'd like to make those working conditions better, but I know that at the very least there is a willingness to do anything necessary to become self-sufficient because they know that this opportunity given to them is so rare, and I think they're so appreciative of it.
No, I think that's a great point. And I think for people who are sort of quote-unquote native-born Americans, there's another sort of knock-on effect. As Mark Twain says, travel is the cure for ignorance. I mean, I remember being a high school student during the Afghanistan war and then people coming to my high school who were from Afghanistan who had fled the conditions there. And it really just made me, I felt, just a more informed individual to be like, okay, I don't just have to hear what's going on from CNN. I can just say like, hey, you know, I'm hearing this, 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 and this about Afghanistan and the way things are happening and the way that you're living and different things like that. You know, what's true, what's false, what's happening, you know, help me understand. And that it gave me, I think, sort of a window that, I mean, even the best, you know, media or whatever that you don't normally have. And being around all these different types of people and learning more about the world, religions, cultures, whatever, it's just all these major issues that are happening on a worldwide scale. It gives you a whole sort of new view of what's going on. And it may or may not change your particular viewpoint, but at the very least, it gives you a more depth and more substance to the things that you think and the things that you act on when you're talking to your legislators about, you know, big, important international issues.
Yeah, I think that I use that quote a lot. The large, that's a paraphrase. Travel's the only cure for ignorance is a paraphrase of a little bit larger, longer quote where Mark Twain says that travel is fatal to bigotry, narrow-mindedness, and prejudice, and that one cannot develop more wholesome views of humanity by vegetating its own corner of the world one's entire life. And I'll just speak for myself. You know, when I became mayor of Clarkston, I actually had never been to the Clarkston Mosque. And I will fully admit that when I came, when I went to the mosque for the first time, you know, growing up in a Methodist church for, you know, 18 years, it was a little weird. You know, I will be quite frank with you. It was weird. It was strange. This, that, different languages, different cultures, religions, you know, rituals, and going to, you know, but going to it, being there in person, you know, and sort of looking past the superficiality of some of these rituals or customs, and recognize a pretty core principle that you see, I think, in every major religion, and that's this this principle of compassion. Muhammad talks about it. Buddha talks about it. The Hindus talk about it. Everyone knows the golden rule. This is the Sermon on the Mount from Jesus, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that is a core principle across all these major religions. And I feel very fortunate to be able to go to the Buddhist temple, the mosque, the churches, the Hindu temple, and to be able to actually have one message of compassion and have that understood by the congregants of all these major religions. To me, it actually gives me a lot, you know, greater hope in sort of a world where hopefully, you know, we'll, you know, world peace, you know, will be a reality one day. And I think it begins with sort of recognizing that a lot of these people who are in different parts of the world and different religions that think that they're in some sort of war against each other. You know, you hear this a lot in some, you know, sectors of our culture in America that we're at war with Islam. And you could argue all day long about, you know, what sect of Islam or what tribal condition and what a Sharia law means and all this. But the Muslims that I know, the Christians that I know, the Hindus and Buddhists that I know, they actually embody that compassionate idea. And if we focus on that and push that as a core principle of what we expect out of our people, then we're going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great point. And I want to turn to a couple other issues here, switching gears, but things that are, I think, relevant to Clarkston that are also big in the news. Clarkston was the first city in Georgia to essentially, I don't want to say decriminalize per se, marijuana. Obviously, it's still particularly a crime, but you're writing tickets for it now. You're not arresting people and throwing them in jail for it. Obviously, our attorney general has said that he wants to, you know, now perhaps review and crack down in an even greater way on different jurisdictions, states, and the like that have changed marijuana laws from what I would call extremely draconian way we've been approaching it for 40 or so years. I mean, what's been the impact of the changes you've seen since you've moved to essentially sort of like a running a red light style of approach?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And actually, I just heard the other day that Israel passed their Knesset passed a marijuana decriminalization bill, and it's more taking a public health approach. Which, you know, I think, you know, even having a conservative government over in Israel, they're recognizing that, you know, these draconian laws aren't effective public safety or public health measures. And, you know, just for Clarkson's purposes, we passed this thing back in July, so it's been about 8 months now. And, you know, we've given out about 20 tickets for this low-level under 1 ounce possession. And so, you know, I mean, I think you could argue, at least in a small town, it probably isn't going to make that much of a difference one way or the other in terms of just sort of overall crime stats. But I think the larger symbolic and sort of community relations aspect of it is so important, because now officers truly have the discretion to say, you know what, this person doesn't need to be arrested. I mean, there's still discretion in there. And so if someone is committing another crime and they have marijuana possession, that all has to go with the state court. So this is a very limited, you know, scope of what we're talking about with what, you know, a municipality can do in Georgia. But I think, you know, the paw over the community, everyone, at least from my anecdotal evidence in the African-American community, knows someone, a family member or a close friend, who has had this run-in with law enforcement, and it has been a negative reaction. And a lot of times it's related to what I think most people would say a nonviolent victimless crime. So someone is happened to be pulled over, you know, driving while black, and they, you know, smell something in the car, they search the car, find marijuana, and then, you know, you get arrested. And this is what was happening, you know, in our town, It's happening in Atlanta. It's happening all over, Georgia. And it just creates this real psychological and actual legal impediment to people trying to get ahead. Because if you look at, just what, most cities do, the most they can charge is $1,000 for a municipal ticket. And so we actually had people getting arrested, paying a $1,000 fine, having their car towed, missing work. And it became this sort of this blowback effect in the community where people who presumably, maybe were on the right track or who maybe just made a simple mistake have now been forced into potential poverty. And that's going to, I believe, and I think has led to more crime in the community, not trying to stop it. And so we just have to think a little bit, more, I think, proactively and actually have evidence-based policies. And so, we'll review this thing later this July after a year. We'll see how it's been going. Do we think we want to tweak it? Do we want to, keep it in effect? I think that's sort of the role of a city council, a mayor, is to pass a policy that we think is right. But if it doesn't work, you try something new. I mean, we're not going to be static. Mm-hmm. We're not going to have the mindset of, well, it's always been done this way, and so we just need to keep doing it. I mean, I think one of the things that I've always pushed as mayor is that we need to challenge conventional wisdom. And if something doesn't seem like it's quite working, then why do we keep doing it?
Well, and one thing I'm curious about with this, too, because I think that that's a great point. And sort of once you have the proof of concept, it really speaks to other things. I mean, Virginia, which is my home state, sort of a relatively similar political profile to some degree as Georgia. Now, even very conservative Republicans are taking up this cause of potentially decriminalizing marijuana on the state level. Actually, Ken Cuccinelli was the former attorney general, very right wing guy. I mean, Georgia, the heavily gerrymandered state, certainly Trump only won by 5 percentage points. So not a state that's dominated in some ways by conservatives as people, but certainly in the state legislature. But some of these things that you guys are doing that I think are, evidence-based, but nevertheless not things that people associate with red states. Do you have any hope that perhaps the state legislature may look at a city like Clarkson and say, hey, let's look at, changing some laws as have happened in Virginia? Or is this sort of gerrymandered reality? And I know last Friday, the Republicans there sort of pushing another bill through that would really keep the districts very gerrymandered. Does that foreclose maybe things sort of moving up the chain?
Well, here's something that's really interesting. So our governor, Nathan Deal, me and him have kind of been on different sides of the issue on the refugee, Syrian refugees at one point. But I got to hand it to him. He spoke at the Republican National Convention last summer about criminal justice reform. And so if I had to forecast where the Republican Party is going on this issue, I think that they are legitimately trying, at least at the state level, trying to find ways to prove sort of this, I think, longstanding kind of charge that Republicans don't care about black people or poor people. I think there's a lot of Republicans who are like, no, we really do. And then the next question is, well, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to prove that you actually care about, this prison, school to prison pipeline and trying to actually make sure that we have a just justice system? So you're seeing that, I think, in legislators. There's still sort of this old guard that view, at least in marijuana reform policies, as this sort of moral indictment. So anyone who does drugs is considered a bad person. Mm. Let's not bring up alcohol or smoking cigarettes, right? Mm. There's a line there where they're like, well, that's okay too. But I think that you're seeing some state reps, some state senators. I was aware of State Senator Harold Jones out in Augusta. His bill, which is kind of a sort of a bringing down the state penalty charge to a lower fine level, passed out of one of the committees. And so, that's the Republican controlled committee. And so I think you're seeing, at least in Georgia, local legislators that actually do want to make some progress on this, on real criminal justice reform.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, I really appreciate you joining the show. That was Mayor Ted Terry of Clarkston, Georgia. Many excellent things going on down there. So don't forget, pay attention to small town America, not just the big cities. That is going to do it for today's show. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.